candidate? Just raise your hand. If they were not here yesterday. So the subject of today's, this morning's Dhamma talk is about the action and its results, or often called the law of karma. And the law of karma is one of the most important and pivotal aspects of life that brings us all of our conflicts and suffering, and it also forms the essential core of the Buddha's teaching about suffering. Like most of you know, that the Buddha's teachings are given in the outline of the Four Noble Truths. That means the suffering, the cause of suffering, that there can be an end to suffering and the path leading to the end of suffering. And according to the Dhamma, all suffering is because of the mind being dominated by greed, hatred, and ignorance. Ignorance means not knowing the truth, not knowing the truth about the mind or the world, not knowing the truth about the intimate interconnection between the world and the mind and how it operates. But because of not understanding that, people do all kinds of unskillful actions that bring them conflicts, pain and suffering. So, and all of the training in the Buddhist teaching, the Noble Eightfold Path, the practice of meditation, the practice of the sila, samadhi and panya, or the practice of dana, sila and panya, meaning the practices of learning to living by the precepts, the practice of dana, the cultivation of metta, practice of meditation, all these different types of practices that you find in the Buddhist teaching are designed at helping to eliminate those negative aspects of our mind and the negative habits, unskillful habits of body, speech, and mind that causes to keep recreating conflicts and suffering in ourself, as well as its entanglement with the outer world and its problems and conflicts with others. So understanding this law of action and result, or law of karma, is really one of the deepest aspects of right understanding. You know that the Eightfold Path starts with right understanding. And that means understanding the suffering, the cause of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the path leading to the ending of suffering. And as I mentioned yesterday, the first two verses of the Dhammapada, the Buddha sums this up very beautifully, in which he said, all actions are led by the mind. Mind is their master, mind is their maker. If one acts or speaks with an impure state of mind, then suffering will follow, as the cart wheel follows the foot of the ox. And in the same way, if a person acts or speaks with the pure state of mind, then happiness will follow, as your shadow follows you without departing. So the law of karma is summed up in those two verses. And what is an impure state of mind? Well, it's defined as our actions of thought and speech in the body, which are driven by attachment and greed, anger and hatred, and selfish type of self-centeredness, pride and conceit, and ignorance that causes us to do all kinds of unskillful things. And there's the actual word kamma or karma in, you know, the popular, what you normally hear in the States is in the law of karma, but in Pali it's called kamma, the same thing. And kamma means action. A lot of people in the New Age movement and people that, you know a little bit about the Dhamma, when something happens to them, say, oh, that's my karma, that's my karma. But actually what happens to them is the result of their karma, is the result of their karma. So every action has a reaction. It's like Newton's law. For every action, there's an equal and opposite the reaction. Sort of like the law of gravity. If you throw something up, it comes down. So if we throw something out of our mouth, it may come back to us. If we throw something out of our mind by negative types of thoughts, it also can come back to us. Or we throw something out of our body by stealing, sexual misconduct, or beating up somebody, or even body language, there may be some result come back to us. So the body, speech, and mind are called the three pathways of kamma, how we create our kamma, or how it has an effect back to us. And this is not some law that the Buddha created or anybody created. This is simply a natural law, like gravity is a natural law. Law of kamma is also one of these laws of nature within the governing the operation of the body and mind. But ultimately, all of our speech and actions come from the mind. And so that's why the process of mental purification is the main focus of the Buddha's teaching, and especially in the practice of meditation, trying to purify the mind of its negative, unwholesome types of thoughts. But in order to purify the mind of its thoughts, we also have to change the way that we behave in the world and interact in the world. So that's why the living by the precepts, following the five precepts or more precepts, but the basic five precepts are the way that we can help minimize the effects of our actions. And you can see in the world, if you just look up in all the types of wars or conflicts in families, conflicts amongst friends, conflicts in society at large, and wars and crimes and all these things that dominate the news and create suffering. You see almost 90% of it, if not more, comes from people not living by these, we call them precepts, but actually a better term would be skillful guidelines of skillful conduct or skillful living. Skillful conduct. That means conduct that doesn't produce suffering in ourselves, in others, or the world. You can see these, I think most of you know these five precepts, but I'll just repeat them quickly. About to restrain from killing or taking life away from others. And this, in the Buddhist teaching, even includes animals and insects. To refrain from killing any living creature. But of course, human beings probably is the most strongest type of comic reaction. But even killing other forms of life, it stems from our ego, thinking that we're somehow better than animals, or that we're somehow more superior to animals or insects. This is a type of conceit, a type of pride. And if we don't have respect for animals and other forms of life, then we're not going to have respect for other things too. And it leads to a meltdown in the mind and leads to careless action. But anyway, let's say especially the killing and harming physically of others. Then there's the stealing, taking what doesn't belong to others, stealing in its various forms, manifestations. Then the sexual abuse of others, or the manipulation, exploitation of others through strong sexual desire, or other forms of sensual addiction. Not only, actually, the third precept doesn't refer to only sexual misconduct. Actually, the meaning is sensual misconduct. And so, in a larger sense, that can be referred to refraining from abusing any kind of sensual addiction. So even, let's say, abusing food, where you're addicted to food and causing it to cause you a lot of suffering to yourself and others through that, or addiction to other types of things, addiction to listening to music, addiction to any sort of addiction that dominates your mind and causes you to create suffering for yourself or others. So this could be included in the precept, because again we're talking about minimize and reducing suffering in ourself as well as our loved ones around us and in the world at large. Then, of course, there's a precept about telling lies and other forms of bad speech. Actually, in the Eightfold Path, there's four types of wrong speech. That is lying, and then malicious speech. That means basically telling tales about others, backbiting, gossiping, rumor-mongering, spreading tales about others in order to divide up the friendships. And that's usually dominated by our ego and wanting to break up friendships. So we tell a rumor about somebody else to alienate them from their girlfriend or boyfriend or their friends or whatever. And then there's the intoxicating the mind, getting drunk. Because when people intoxicate the mind, they go out and do things they ordinarily wouldn't do. drunk driving, for example. Go out and kill others, or on drugs. So anyway, these five precepts are the not obeying or living by these five precepts, which generate probably 90% of the suffering in its various offshoots and ramifications in the whole world. And that's why the Buddha said that if a person could just follow the five precepts, this earth would be transformed into a heaven, basically. It would be heaven. Almost all the conflicts in the world would be eliminated. So why can't people follow the five precepts? It's so obvious, isn't it? You think? Because they can't control their mind. They can't control their urges and impulses. And also, because of wrong views and because of the sort of glorification of the ego, and especially in the Western countries and so on, and this is the idea of, get what you want, and, the strengthening of the self. So that leads to a lot of that. But basically it comes to not being able to control our thoughts and impulses. So the Buddha listed 10 unskillful actions that bring the painful results. And I basically have already mentioned them, but they include the killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, the 4 times of wrong speech. Actually, I only mentioned a couple, but telling lies, malicious speech, and also harsh speech. That means using vulgar words, swear words, especially with hatred behind them, calling you dirty so-and-so, and 4-letter words and all that. Harsh speech that hurts people, or telling colored jokes, ethnic jokes, blue jokes, whatever you want to call them, that hurt people. And then also useless speech. Useless speech is probably harder for most people to practice. There's been a lot of gray areas in useless speech, but especially those first 3 forms, it causes lots of suffering. And you can easily see that. But these are habits that almost the whole society is caught up in, because we, from a very young age, we hear our parents talking like that. We hear people on the TV sitcoms talking like that. We read it in the newspapers, and especially the politicians also. So naturally, these become strong habits that are overcome. But these are, and then. So there's 3 negative actions by the body that I just mentioned, the killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. 4 actions by speech, the telling lies, malicious speech, or rumor mongering, the harsh speech and the useless speech. And there's 3 by the mind, which is having wrong views. And help me if I get one wrong. There's ignorance, I think, wrong views, and conceit, right? So these are called the negative actions of the mind. Conceit means, this glorifying the I. I am better than others. Vanity, pride. This is because this is in your mind, embedded deep within the mind. But it's a leads. To so much of the wrong type of actions. And then the ignorance, that means not knowing the truth. This is also embedded in the mind. And the wrong views, right? So wrong views about the world. So these are called the 10 unskillful actions, which create virtually, all the types of suffering that one experiences. But if you boil them down, if you can't remember all 10 of those, they all boil down to greed, hatred, and ignorance. So most people are like a blind person, just blindly following their passions, their desires, their whims and fancies and ideas, and just going out, and because they don't control their mind, they're getting caught up in the web of karma. And we call it the web of karma because our actions ripple out. Even one thing that you say here, one thing that you whisper to a friend, thinking you can trust that friend, and then they go out and blab it to others, that could go around the world, and especially now with Twitter and all these other weird things on the internet. One thing that you say here could be broadcast around the world in 10 minutes, isn't it? So you can see how, even such innocent little actions here, maybe we think it's just hurting ourselves. No, it goes out and can spread around the world. And so the web of karma is sort of like a spider web. And anything that happens in any one place jiggles the whole web. That means it can have effects coming back to us, even over a long period of time. And there's some of these karmic effects that have their immediate result. Let's say if you insult somebody to their face, they might, you know, punch you in the nose. You know, instant kind of result. Or if out of greed, if you overeat and get a bellyache or heartburn, so that's a kind of a instant result. But if you steal something, you may not get caught right away, but it may come a week or a month down the line, or if you tell a lie, or if you do any of these other types of wrong speech, you know, they can come back to us after time. But more importantly, the immediate result is guilt, worry, remorse, and fear. So whenever we do these types of actions, because in every society, basically, these moral guidelines are similar in most societies. Even, you know, in the Christian teachings, the Buddhist teachings, almost all the Hinduism, these basic types of morality are there. But sometimes they're not stressed or emphasized so much. And so these moral guidelines is what's that help to keep harmony in the world, to control people. And a lot of times it might be like the fear of God, just to use the example from Christianity. So the commandments are you obey these because God will punish you. Now whether that's true or not is another thing. But the idea is that if you think you're going to get punished, then hopefully you would try not to do those actions. So in the law of karma, when we say your actions have a result, it's not, the result is not coming from some higher power or authority, but the painful result of our actions is coming because of this natural sort of boomerang effect. But if you know that, then you know that you're responsible for your own suffering and not somebody else. And so hopefully that will give you enough motivation to do something about it. Because no one can purify your own mind. And the Buddha in another Dhammapada verse, he said that, one by oneself is the mind defiled, and by oneself is the mind purified. And no one can purify another. Because the source and cause of all these actions and thoughts is within our own mind. And no one can really go into your own mind and change it. Now we can manipulate people and try to control people. And like with young people, the parents, you know, they tell their children, you know, come in by 10 o'clock and don't hang out with this person and don't smoke marijuana and don't do all these things, right? But oftentimes the kids don't listen. And, people try to control others by various rules and regulations. But because these inner impulses and so on are so strong, people go on, they largely can't follow them. And so they go on doing things that bring them various types of conflict and suffering. And in the Buddhist teaching, you know, the path, the Noble Eightfold Path is designed to, you know, bring an end to the suffering. And basically there's three levels of suffering. There's the suffering we cause to our physical body and the various physical pains and so on. A lot of them are caused by ourselves. Like if you overeat, you get a bellyache, eat the wrong kind of foods, or take impure substances, you could get all various types of diseases, or because we're unmindful, we go out and get into accidents and cut ourselves, fall down, break our leg, or so many other things. And then there's the suffering, mental suffering of not getting what we want and getting what we don't want, not being able to satisfy our desires. Like the young kids and their parents put them on curfew or give them all these, and they can't go out and hang with their friends, you know, past the 10 o'clock, all these restrictions, so they suffer. And they, you know, do temper tantrums and all kinds of things. You know, all of us were young, so we know that. So, you know, getting what you, not getting what you want and getting what you don't want. So this is more of a mental suffering. And then also the suffering of guilt, worry, remorse, and fear. So it's mostly mental suffering. So there's physical suffering, what I call physical suffering, the result of one's actions also. You know, if you insult somebody and they punch you and break your nose, you know, then, well, that's physical suffering, the result of. And then the mental suffering of guilt, worry, remorse, and fear from having done those things, that you can't sleep at night and somebody going to find out that lie I told, or somebody going to find out that I, you know, stole something. And then there's the third level of suffering, what I call ignorance or spiritual suffering. That means the suffering from kind of just being in confusion, not knowing the truth, and kind of just feeling lonely and you know, confused about life. And so that's a kind of what you could call spiritual suffering, because we don't know the truth. We're not awaken to any higher spiritual kind of truth. And the Noble Eightfold Path is broken into three main categories, as most of you probably know, called the Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. These are Pali words, but the English meanings are skillful conduct. That means living by the precepts. concentration, that means the practice of meditation. Practicing mindfulness and concentration, as we were talking and practicing about yesterday. And then the wisdom. That means understanding the Dhamma, understanding the Four Noble Truths, understanding the law of karma, and so on, understanding impermanence. And these three levels of skillful conduct, concentration or meditation, and wisdom address those three levels of suffering. So, sila is the practice of the precepts that we've already mentioned. And so by restraining from those five types of negative behaviors, we can minimize at least, let's say, 75% of the unnecessary types of heavy suffering that come to us, that come as a result of those five actions, which are guilt, worry, remorse, and fear, and also the physical things that could happen to you if people find out that you killed, lied, steal, and slept with their wife or husband, or so on. You all know that. You get beaten, broken bones, killed, put in prison. So many types of heavy suffering. But then even if a person didn't do that, and didn't have a lot of those heavy types of mental and physical results, they'd still suffer in their mind subtler levels of just the kind of dissatisfaction, discontent, restlessness, are still, you know, craving and desire or anger of other forms that may not lead to those negative behaviors, but nevertheless still disturb their mind and keep their mind in a state of dissatisfiedness, restlessness, always wanting, needing to do things. And even if a person didn't have those negative states of mind or those that type of mental agitation and unrest, they still might suffer from not knowing the truth or just feeling like a separate individual that's separated from the whole and kind of just wandering aimlessly in life without any type of real anchor. So, you know, the people, but the practice of sila or the skillful conduct, you see, these are like it's forcing you to behave. It's like a policeman watching you. So when a policeman's watching you, or your parents are watching you, oh, good little child. But as soon as they're gone, then, you know, you go out and smoke a cigarette when your parents aren't watching, the policeman's not watching, you know, or overdo the speed limit, or whatever. So the practice of sila is like having a policeman in our mind. Don't do that. So we have to force ourselves, you know, not to kill the cockroaches in your house, or not to put out poison for the ants. Mm-hmm. But you'd like to because it's the easy way out. Or force yourself not to tell that lie on your job application, or whatever other application is there. You'd like to because it's the easy way out. But, you know, because you've taken sila, there's that policeman in your mind saying, no, 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 you're going to get suffering if you do that. So you kind of force yourself not to. And the same with the other precepts. You'd like to tell that rumor about somebody. Go and spread some malicious rumor about somebody. Oh, so-and-so slept with so-and-so. But because of the precept, you can force yourself not to. Or you like to go out and get drunk, but you drink and you force yourself not to. That means if you've done those things in the past, and now you're trying to practice the Dhamma and trying to change those habits, but you see they're still very strong. So that, let's say you're meditating and then a mosquito starts buzzing around. And the mosquito lands on your head and starts biting. And so you see this urge to want to kill it, you know. So you raise the arm up and at the last minute, no, panati pata veramani. And you kind of force yourself to put your arm down, which you would have liked to have killed the mosquito. So like that, the sila is this kind of this enforced behavior. But it's good in that factor, because if we didn't have it, you wouldn't think twice to do these types of behaviors and then suffer the consequences of it. So that's why sila alone is not enough. And that's why, but the practice of sila will help to prevent a lot of these gross types of suffering that we mentioned. But in the practice of meditation, when you gain concentration and mindfulness and start to experience a deeper level of peace that comes out of meditation and are purifying your thoughts of greed and anger and developing some wisdom, And in deep meditation, when the mind becomes very peaceful, there's not even any desire to do anything. no thought of wanting to break any of those precepts would even come into your mind during a deeper state of meditation. Because the meditation helps to tranquilize these kind of gross thoughts, and these negative types of behaviors. So that with the continued practice of meditation, and you start to sort of transform your nervous system into a more mellow one, then, and when your wisdom is developed, then even the desires to do those things will gradually lessen. And your mindfulness will be so quick that, you wouldn't do those. And also, when you start to experience the lightness of mind that comes through having practiced the sila, then you want to practice it even more. Because you see how troubled your life was before you practiced the precepts. And then sometime later, after practicing them for a period of time, you see how the quality of your mind and nervous system and life has become much better, free from anxiety and guilt, worry, remorse, and fear. So you naturally will start practicing. You don't have to force yourself to do it anymore. And the mind becomes more peaceful. That is why the meditation is important, to go from that one gross level of practicing sila to a more natural mental sila. But even the concentration, the meditation, isn't enough. Especially if you just concentrate. Because anybody who's, can sit and, let's say, you just focus your attention at the nostrils and the mind becomes calm. But when you come out of the meditation, the old mind will come up again and start being active. Because just concentrating your mind by chanting a mantra, by just practicing anapanasati, or some form of concentration, is like pushing the head of the jack-in-the-box down into the tin box and putting on the lid. But what's underneath the head of the jack? It's a spring, right? There's a lot of power. So as soon as you take the lid off the box, come out of your meditation, whoosh, the head springs up. And the head basically is the ego, I, me, and mine, and greed, hatred, and delusion. So it comes back up and be active again. So that's why even meditation alone is not enough. It's a temporary effect, and of course it's very powerful, but that's why the wisdom is sort of the crowning jewel in the three stages of sila, samadhi, and panya, or skillful conduct, concentration, and wisdom. That is the sort of the crowning jewel. Because it's the wisdom is like, we talked about this wisdom yesterday. It means the insight that's able to penetrate into the very source of the mind and to see how the ego is an illusion. And when you see how the ego is an illusion, that has a very powerful impact on the unconscious mind. And it's like going down into the jack-in-the-box, or maybe from underneath, with a pair of wire clippers. And you clip the spring. And maybe you don't cut it all the way in half in the beginning. But even if you clip it a little bit, you weaken some of the power. So the next time you take the head off, instead of it jumping out like this, it kind of just comes up a little bit slowly and, maybe to a certain distance. So that's with those stages of enlightenment. And each time you go in and you have a deep experience of meditation and wisdom, especially this seeing the illusion of the ego and being able to abide in the, the more expanded awareness and so on for longer periods of time, it's like weakening that spring a little bit more. Till at a certain point, it's cut completely through, and then that's the end of the suffering. But anyway, that's how those three stages work on dealing with this overcoming or purifying the actions of the body, speech, and mind. And the mind, of course, is what drives all bodily actions and speech. That's why just forcing yourself to be good and not speak bad things is not going to work, because the thoughts are still within our mind, and only meditation can reach the unconscious mind, because the impulses for our speech and actions are coming from basically the cellular level of the nervous system, very deeply embedded, that we can't reach by normal means. And also the law of karma is a kind of you can make it a meditation too. And just by going back and remembering all the things that you did in your life that you didn't follow those precepts, the kind of suffering and conflicts and problems that it got you into. And not only yourself, but your brother, or your sister, or your mother, or your father, or other relatives. And certainly every time you look at the news, you greed, hatred, and delusion, and all those precepts being broken, that's all you see. Not all, but it's 75% of everything you see and hear on the news, isn't it? And so by reinforcing it, when you see somebody do something, you say, I don't want to be like that. And you see the suffering in their lives, all these movie stars and all these other types of people that you think are the people glorify, but yet the lives are, a lot of them are a total mess. So that's why the practice of the meditation is so important in order to transform those unskillful types of actions. And also, when you start to meditate and you start to experience the subtle kind of bliss and happiness that comes from the peaceful mind, you start wanting that more, and doing those other things start to look like laying in a mud puddle. You wouldn't want to go and lay in a mud puddle, right? You like to have nice, clean clothes. But when you reflect back and you see the suffering that caused by telling lies, stealing, having greed and hatred in the mind, and all this unskillful behavior and neurotic type of reactions, when you reflect back on it, it's like laying in a mud puddle in terms of the mind, in terms of the quality of the mind and the peace and equanimity that comes through long-term practice of the Dhamma. You wouldn't want to go back to that. And so, the practice of the Buddha's teaching is, the practice of purification of these states of mind, so that we don't get the results back of our actions. And also, karma is not some kind of reward and punishment. And of course, there's good types of karma too. I've only been talking about the negative kind, but the good actions are refraining from the bad actions, and the practice of dana, generosity, giving, the practice of sila, the practice of metta, and the practice of meditation. These are said by the Buddha to be the highest forms of good karma. So when you give to charity selflessly, and you give something of what you have to others, not thinking I just keep everything for myself, but you give and share with others. That also opens up our heart and helps to weaken our strong, self-centered, I, me, mine type of orientation. So that's considered good karma, because it helps us gradually follow or proceed in that the direction of liberation. Liberation from the ego. That's the strongest prison, is the liberation from I, me, and mine. And so the practice of dana is considered to be very meritorious actions. But the practice of sila is said to be even better than that, more powerful in terms of karmic liberation. The practice of sila. And the Buddha said, if you give dana for 100 years but don't practice sila, it may have some effect, but practicing sila only for one day is better than practicing dana for 100 years without practicing sila. So practicing sila is even more important in terms of the merit. You've heard the word merit a lot in the Buddhist circles, you know. And merit is basically our wholesome actions in what helps to lead us toward liberation from suffering. And demerit is what keeps our mind more entrenched in the negative law of karma in a negative sense in the suffering. And then even more important than sila is the practice of the bhavana, meditation. That's even considered more meritorious. And the Buddha said, if you practice sila for 100 years without meditation, you know, you might go to heaven, but you might go to hell also. But if you practice meditation just for one day, is more beneficial than practicing sila for 100 years without practicing meditation. So that's why meditation is seen to be the highest form of karma. That means the active purification of one's views and thoughts through the practice of meditation is the highest type of good karma that brings the beneficial results, because your mind is becoming more calm, less neurotic, less uptight, greed and anger is reducing, and so on. So that's the highest kind of good karma, because everything else is generated by that. So, and these are things that will have their effect even long into the future. Just as somebody who commits a crime now, they don't find out about it, but 30, 50 years later, they're finding out, and these people now that are 80 years old, they're going to prison to die in prison. But they might have gotten away with their crime for so long, but then eventually they got caught. So the same way, we might do a good action now, maybe no immediate kind of result, except we'll feel good. The immediate result is when you do something good, you feel good. When you've done your 30 minutes or 45 minutes of meditation in the morning, and you feel good about that. But when you miss doing the meditation in the morning, you might say, I should have done that meditation. I didn't. You might not feel so good. So that's the immediate effect of a bad action. But the long-term effect can even have its effect in the future life. But if you don't believe in that, well, you know, you don't have to. But even it will have its effect, you know, in next week, or next month, or next year, or throughout our life. The effects of those good actions will keep coming. And just one last kind of note on this is that even the bad things that happen to you, or painful things, this is said to be the result of, you know, one's past actions. And it could even be coming from a past life, or it could be coming from some years ago, things that we did we might have forgot about. And but it's the accumulation of all those types of actions that have the result. And it's not that each action that you've ever done has a result. Some people believe that. And they think, If they sneeze, they say, oh God, what did I do in a past life? Did I kill a mosquito or something? So they think that every single kind of pain that comes to them is a result of past action. That is also not correct. That just having a body, we're subject to various types of sicknesses and diseases, and may not have nothing to do with anything you did in a past life. Although it could, in some certain circumstances, it may. But certainly not the common things like getting the cold, getting the measles, and all these sort of things. It's a result of having a human body, of course. And we were born as a, because we've done past karma. I'm going to talk more about that in the talk in the afternoon. But but karma should be seen as an evolutionary tool. That means we keep doing the same thing over and over again, and we keep suffering on it. So at some point we wake up and we get fed up with the suffering and say, you know, what am I doing with this? And will cause you then to make changes in the life so you don't you don't keep on causing suffering to yourself. Or other things, we get something happens to us, let's say like this is a common example now, maybe people's parents or they have a child who's becomes a, you have to take care of them for a long period of time. You know, your parents get Alzheimer's or something else, or somebody get paraplegic, and then there's no one. You have to be their caregiver. Maybe you didn't want to. You want to enjoy your life, be free. Then all of a sudden you are saddled with this. Or maybe you're born with a child that has some kind of conditions. And that might be what you need. That might be part of what you need to evolve because of some character traits in the past or selfishness in the past. And then you get to a situation where your freedom is curtailed by that. But maybe that is necessary for one's growth, to learn. So the unfortunate situations that happen to us in life, we shouldn't see them in terms of blessings and curses, but we should see it as, what is this telling me? What can I learn from this? Not finding blame with others or feeling self-pity, but as, what can I learn from this? Yes, it's painful, it may not be pleasant, but it's there. It's a happen, there's nothing can be done about it. What is it teaching me? And to try to see it in those terms and get a lesson from it. Learn from it rather than just saying, oh, this is a curse, or a burden, because you just create more suffering for yourself. So karma works in that way. We may not know why things happen to us, but nothing happens without some kind of a reason, basically. And some of those reasons may be rooted in the past and our karma, and others may be rooted in just the fact that you were born as a human being and you have this body and things happen. People die in a hurricane, and one person didn't die out of a family or a whole neighborhood, and why that person lived and all these other people died. It's a very common question that is asked. And of course, we can't say with any accuracy why that happened, but they happen. And the happen is because of we were born, and things happen. And I went to an autopsy in Brazil just to see what my reaction would be. And they have to determine the cause of death. So if they don't know how a person died, they do an autopsy to find out how they died. They have to write it on the certificate, this person died of this. So the doctor there says, sometimes we can't find the cause of death. And I said, then you write on the certificate, birth. Birth is the cause of death, or birth is the cause of any type of suffering that you may experience. Anyway, I'll probably be touching on some of these topics again this afternoon when I talk about the nature of life and death and the idea of, you know, the afterlife or what's beyond death, the idea of a rebirth and so on. That was a topic that was given to me or put on the list. So, but anyway, now it's our lunchtime, so we're going to have a break for the lunch. And we'll meet again. I think there's, according to the schedule, maybe walking meditation, or after your lunch, you can come and do walking meditation. Then I think at 1 o'clock or 1:30, I'll be giving another Dhamma talk. And we'll have some meditation after that, or before the, you know, if you want to come in and meditate, even after your lunch, whether walking or sitting, you can do that.